Hey y'all, welcome to this week's episode of Unfit to Print. I'm your host, Amber Athey. I'm the Spectator USA's Washington editor and a Tony Blankley fellow with the Steamboat Institute. Before we get started, make sure that you guys go ahead and subscribe to the Daily Caller's YouTube channel and hit that notification bell, and also search for the podcast on iTunes and SoundCloud. And if you guys are looking for some daddy issues this Father's Day, I'm afraid to say that you're not going to find them on this podcast, but you will find plenty of issues of the Spectator USA's magazine if you head on over to spectator.us. We're currently offering a special Father's Day deal where with the discount code FATHER, you'll get 25% off a subscription. Use the discount code AMBER on top of that and you'll get another 10% off. Sounds like a pretty good deal. Let's talk about the Rayshard Brooks case in Atlanta. Black Lives Matter is making a lot of hay out of this case. They say that this is essentially the same thing that happened to George Floyd, where a group of racist police officers have unjustly killed an unarmed black man. But let's go ahead and walk through the facts in the case, because I don't think that they support that theory. Brooks apparently fell asleep while going through a Wendy's drive-thru and was blocking other cars from getting in. So the police showed up and they breathalyzed Brooks and found that he was too drunk to drive. So they decided to arrest him, but in the process, Brooks resisted arrest, stole a police officer's taser, started to run away from the officers, but then turned around and fired the taser, causing one of the police officers to pull out his gun and shoot Brooks 3 times. One of the officers went to radio for help, and then they gave him CPR until help arrived. Unfortunately, Brooks later died at the hospital. Obviously a tragedy anytime someone loses their life, but just based on the video that I've watched and based on the facts in the case, sounds to me like this was a justified shooting, or at least a shooting where the officer could credibly say that they were in fear for their life. A taser is not a deadly weapon, to be sure, and the cop wouldn't have died by getting tased by Brooks, but an officer never wants to be incapacitated on the scene because there's always the chance that the suspect could take the officer's sidearm and execute them. There have been many cases where this has happened. An officer needs to be alert and conscious at all times while apprehending a suspect. So I suspect that is why they chose to take down Brooks using lethal force. What has happened in the aftermath, I think, is a miscarriage of justice. The officer who shot Brooks has been fired from his job. The other officer who was on scene has been placed on administrative leave. And the district attorney in Atlanta has decided to press felony murder charges against the officer who fired his weapon. Now, even worse, the DA decided to essentially try his case in front of the public, claiming all of these details, like the officer was standing on Brooks's shoulders after he was shot and laying on the ground, and claiming that he kicked Brooks while he was laying on the ground. We've only seen still images of this. We haven't seen the video of the officer kicking him, which I think is a little bit convenient. But that being said, that doesn't change the fact of whether or not the shooting was justified. And the DA is clearly trying to sway public opinion, which is going to make jury selection very difficult. It's going to be very difficult to find people who haven't heard about the details in this case after this DA's press conference. It's going to be very hard to find people who are unbiased. So that, I think, is an intentional way that the DA is trying to subvert justice a little bit here. Police officers are so upset at this felony charge, in fact, that they have been calling in sick and walking off the job in Atlanta in droves, which seems like a proportionate response. Police officers are brothers, and when one of their brothers goes down or is unjustly charged with murder, they're going to respond and stand by him. The biggest problem in all of this, in my opinion, though, is that these DAs and attorney generals and other people involved in these state and local justice systems are giving into mob rule and mob justice. And they're overcharging police officers in order to prove a point to activists who are rioting and looting in the cities. So in this case, it's probably going to be pretty hard to get a jury to agree that this guy committed felony murder. I don't really know of a jury that would convict based on the video that I've seen. And the consequence of overcharging is that it's more likely that the police officer is going to be acquitted. And guess what? All of the activists who have been calling for this guy's head are going to be even angrier than they were in the first place. And we're going to see even more riots in the streets over the verdict. The same thing actually happened in Minneapolis with George Floyd. Keith Ellison, the AG there, decided to up the murder charge to a second degree murder charge, which again is more difficult to prove. Chauvin, the case I think is a little bit stronger than the one against the cop in Atlanta, particularly because the video was so damning and because there was no instance where George Floyd attempted to incapacitate one of the officers who was arresting him. But that being said, every time that you up the charge, this is a legal strategy where you are making it more difficult to prove your case. The higher the charge, the more difficult it is to prove that the person committed it. And if you're upping charges for the purpose of appeasing a social justice mob, then you're only, again, making it more likely that this person is going to be acquitted of the charges. And the consequences of that is going to be that the people like Black Lives Matter and other activist organizations who want these police officers to get the death penalty, they're going to be even angrier. They're going to riot more. They're going to loot more. They're going to burn down more buildings. And we're going to see the natural consequence of this slogan, no justice, no peace. This is a subversion of the justice system for these guys to be constantly overcharging these police officers. And the results are not going to be good for society. I promise you that. If any of y'all are curious about John Bolton's new book about his time as the National Security Advisor in the Trump administration, I have received a copy of the book from a very trusted source and I have skimmed through it. And my initial reaction is that the book is really boring. Bolton's not a very engaging writer. In terms of juicy details, there really aren't that many that are surprising. There was, of course, this claim that Trump had personally asked Xi Jinping for his help in the 2020 re-election campaign and apparently approved of the idea of China putting Uyghur Muslims in concentration camps, which doesn't seem accurate considering just on Wednesday, the president decided to sign a Human Rights Violation Act in regards to the Uyghurs, saying that anyone who is complicit in the concentration camp situation will be held criminally liable. So that doesn't really ring true for me. Now, the rest of the book, I think, gives a little bit of insight into Bolton's mindset as a neoconservative and how he views war. It's funny to me that the media has really embraced him as a hero because he's criticizing the president. This is a common thing that they do, where they have nothing but horrible things to say about someone when they're either a Fox News contributor or a member of the Trump administration. But then as soon as they flip on the guy, all of a sudden they're hailed as the new savior of the republic. So John Bolton writes in his book about Trump trying to pull troops from Afghanistan and Syria, that his argument against doing so was that they didn't start the war and they can't decide when to end it. This, of course, is a total abdication of responsibility from people who are supposed to be in leadership positions. It doesn't matter to me who started the war. If you have been in that war for almost two decades and are seeing zero returns or zero attempts at completion or progress, then it's time to get the hell out. I don't really care how you do it, but at some point you have to cut your losses and move on. But Bolton would be happy to keep, you know, other people's sons and daughters over in Afghanistan and Syria for as long as his little mustache can handle it. That's just the way that these types of warmongers and hawks think about the world, is that we always have to have a presence in other places, because if not, they're going to come to America's shores and attack us. So that was a little tidbit into John Bolton's insight. I think it's clear to me that the main crux of his opposition to Trump is the fact that the two just didn't agree on foreign policy. Trump wanted to pull troops from Afghanistan and Syria. He wanted to get rid of endless wars in the Middle East. And Bolton fundamentally doesn't want to do that. That's fine. They have a difference of agreement. Trump shouldn't have hired someone who was fundamentally opposed to his idea of foreign policy. And Bolton should get off his high horse and not go after the president just because they had a difference of opinion. That's my take on the Bolton book. In terms of big scoops or bombshells, I don't really think there are any. Again, I don't think this China thing is really going to hold up to scrutiny. Robert Lighthizer has already denied it. So we'll see what happens. The other part of this too is that the White House wanted to stop Bolton from releasing the book. And when you read through it, it makes sense why. He has all of these private conversations between Trump and various foreign leaders that have not been made public, including conversations with Kim Jong-un, Vladimir Putin, Benjamin Netanyahu. All of these things that I suspect are considered confidential have been put into this Bolton book. So it makes sense to me why the White House would say, you can't release this while Trump is still in office because this could be very damaging to American foreign policy. Apparently, his team has responded by deciding to leak the book to the press so that they can simply report out all of this stuff that really shouldn't be seeing the light of day when the administration is still sitting in the White House. But Bolton, I guess, is more interested in getting his multi-million dollar advance from his book publisher than he is in protecting national security. Really a sad state of affairs. I warned on this show a while ago, I want to say probably like 6 months ago, that the tactics that the mainstream media was using to deplatform websites like InfoWars from social media were eventually going to be used on more establishment, moderate, conservative outlets. And it turns out that I was right, which I don't want to be right because I don't want conservative outlets to be deplatformed. But this week, NBC News tried to use Google to deplatform The Federalist and ban them from Google's ad revenue service. So what happened was NBC News published an article on Tuesday where they claimed that Google had banned The Federalist from its ad service, meaning that The Federalist would not be able to make money by running Google ads on its website because The Federalist had apparently published derogatory articles. So in this NBC News article, they got a statement from a Google spokesperson who said, quote, "We have strict publisher policies that govern the content ads can run on and explicitly prohibit derogatory content that promotes hatred, intolerance, violence, or discrimination based on race from monetizing. When a page or site violates our policies, we take action. In this case, we've removed both sites," referring to The Federalist and Zero Hedge, "ability to monetize with Google." So according to NBC News, the articles from The Federalist that were derogatory and worthy of them being banned were articles that criticized the mainstream media for its coverage of the riots and criticized the Black Lives Matter movement. Now, I personally don't see how either of those articles would be considered derogatory or discriminatory. Those are both pretty standard conservative positions to have. If those are the types of things that are getting websites banned from Google's ad service, then every conservative website that exists obviously should be very concerned. I don't know a single website from the Washington Examiner to the Daily Caller to the Spectator that hasn't criticized the media's response to the riots because they've been consistently downplaying the fact that they even exist. CNN's Brian Stelter, for example, was complaining about Fox's coverage, saying that the riots were over weeks ago, when at the time he was saying that, there were groups of people, of course, taking over an autonomous zone in Seattle and forcing police out of the area. So that's a totally reasonable position to have, but apparently not if you're NBC News trying to deplatform The Federalist. Now, what is especially disturbing about this is the way that NBC actually went about finding out that this content was demonetized. They didn't just report on a decision from Google. They actually took an activist role in this situation because they were the ones who first flagged this content for Google. And they did so with the help of a British nonprofit group that bills itself as a group that is trying to remove hate from the internet. It's an anti-hate group. So the reporter's name who wrote this NBC article is Adele Momoko Frazier. And Frazier celebrated in a tweet after she published this article her collaboration with these anti-hate campaigns. So the anti-hate campaigns apparently flagged these Federalist articles, gave them to this NBC reporter, who then went to Google to try to get the Federalist banned. Again, that's not journalism, that's called activism. And it's not even really good activism. I don't know if this reporter thought she was doing a good thing and is really on the side of this anti-hate group. But in reality, what happened is that NBC News colluded with a foreign organization to try to get rid of their competition. That's exactly what happened here. They were using and abusing the big tech rules and terms of service to make sure that they don't have competition from conservative outlets. It's a very cynical way of using these anti-hate campaigns and this activism, it's really just intended to make sure that NBC News can get rid of anyone who's challenging them. Now, the other funny part of this is that after this whole scandal, everyone on Twitter was talking about this, defending the Federalist. It turns out that NBC News got the story wrong. so they're the ones who flagged this for Google. It turns out that Google later came out and said that the Federalist was never actually demonetized. They reached out to the Federalist because of some, I guess, offensive things in their comment section, told them that they would have 3 days to fix the comment section. The Federalist then disabled the comment section temporarily, and Google said, okay, well, that resolves the issue. Now, to be fair to NBC, they had this this statement from the Google spokesperson saying that the Federalist had been banned from the ad service, and Google really hasn't explained that inconsistency. It seems like they probably reached out to maybe two different PR departments in Google, and those departments failed to communicate. But NBC News, this whole article, the premise of it is obviously incorrect. And the Federalist explained, its editors explained, that they weren't even contacted by Google until after the NBC News article went up. So it would have been impossible for Google to tell the Federalists that they were getting a warning or that they were being demonetized, because they didn't even hear from Google until after this article was published. So what NBC News did is they added a little line to their article explaining that a spokesperson said the Federalist had never been demonetized, but they didn't actually issue a correction on their article. And really, the whole article should be retracted because, again, the premise of it is incorrect. The other piece of hypocrisy on this is coming from Google, not NBC News, because Google has consistently argued, along with other big tech companies, that they are not responsible for content that they publish that is created by other people. So this is what gives them that exemption under Section 230, where they are not regulated by the government. They don't have liability for publishing other people's content. But Google, in this case, wants to make the Federalist liable for their content or their comment section, which suggests they want the Federalist to be held liable for, again, the views of other people. So Google is engaged in a serious case of hypocrisy here. If they think they shouldn't be held accountable for the things that they publish that are written by other people, but the Federalist should apparently not be able to monetize using their ad platform because of, again, the views of other people in their comments section. It really gives fuel to the fire in terms of conservatives arguing for big tech censorship and revoking their exemptions under Section 230. Finally, I just want to say to the reporter who did this, her name again is, her last name is Fraser. She's really young. I think she's in her early 20s. I'm not much older than her. I'm 26. So I understand that you can get things wrong that early in your career. She's clearly a very inexperienced journalist. I know that doesn't feel good. I just hope that what she takes from this experience is that she went about this the wrong way, and this is a good learning experience. And I hope this doesn't cause her to double down and work even harder to try to censor opinions that she doesn't agree with or that NBC News is trying to stifle. That would be the right thing for her to take away from this, is that she made a mistake. She needs to work a little bit harder to be an unbiased, objective journalist and not just a puppet mouthpiece for an activist organization. CNN's Brian Stelter decided to have a little bit of ideological diversity on his show this past weekend, and he invited on the Trump campaign's legal advisor, Jenna Ellis, to explain why the campaign was sending cease and desist letters to CNN over a poll they ran about Joe Biden leading Donald Trump in the general election. Go ahead and watch Jenna's explanation for why the campaign sent that cease and desist letter.
What's the legal claim that you believe you have against CNN regarding polling data?
Look, no pollster in the world would stand behind this as a legitimate poll according to industry standards. So why would CNN?
What industry standards?
Why? For one reason. For
this
one
poll is in
reason,
line
Brian,
with
and
other
that's because
polls.
They want to undermine.
Pretty much every poll
and
shows
let me
Trump
finish.
Losing
they
to Biden.
They want to undermine. That's not true. You polled adults, not registered voters, not likely voters, but
that's
just
a normal
adults.
Polling procedure.
And that is not the industry standard.
As you can see, Jenna explains that the Trump campaign's issue with the CNN poll is that it's polling all Americans rather than registered voters. So the results aren't super useful because you get a bunch of people who are not able to or don't even intend on voting in the election. But this answer burned Brian Stelter up so much that he took this interview to a very personal place. He suggested that Jenna's children and grandchildren would be ashamed of her because of her attacks on the media. Watch this.
Someday you're going to regret this when your kids and your grandkids look back at this time
truth.
And you use slurs and smears like fake news to
That's
hurt news
you
outlets.
No, but debate, it's, Brian, is
Jenna,
you can't even come on.
I think in 10 or 20
truth.
Years,
no,
if we just sit down
on,
and talk about
really
this, you're
going
to recognize
Brian.
How damaging it was.
I want to give credit to Jenna here for her calm and classy response, because if it were me that Brian Stelter was casting aspersions on and talking about my children or future generations, I would have absolutely lost it. This is a beyond disgusting thing for him to say. First of all, it's none of his goddamn business what her kids think about her or what her grandchildren think about her. And two, there's always been a rule in politics that you leave people's families out of the debate. Clearly, Brian Stelter did not get that memo. He deserved a lot more heat than Jenna gave him, but she was exactly right in her response that his reaction just proves that the media is a bunch of activists rather than journalists. For him to be making judgments about what her kids might think about something is not journalistic in nature at all. That's, again, an activist move. This is a beyond inappropriate thing for Brian Stelter to say, and the Trump campaign has asked him to apologize. I agree, he absolutely should. I've had a lot of people come after me on social media in my day, but I can definitively say that I have never been owned by a pizza chain. Rick Wilson, unfortunately, cannot say the same. This guy is a never Trumper who helped found the Lincoln Project, which is supposed to be a PAC, but really it's just a way for a bunch of never Trumpers to get together and circle jerk about how much they hate the president. They release these ads in favor of Joe Biden and against Trump that are pretty much solely watched by liberal wine moms on Twitter. And, you know, it's really cute. They think they're making a difference. But Rick Wilson decided to go digging for old tweets this week. You know, he's going gold mining for some content, I guess, getting really desperate. And he found a tweet from 2012 where Kayleigh McEnany, who is now the White House press secretary, at the time, I don't think she was even involved in politics. I believe she was actually still a college student, if not a law student. She tweeted at Domino's Pizza talking about how much she loves their pizza and how she thinks it's better than New York style pizza, which is not the best opinion, but you know, you can't cancel a girl for liking Domino's. Domino's Pizza responded to Kayleigh McEnany at the time, thanking her for her appreciation. And Rick Wilson decided that this needed to be the end of Domino's. Domino's is finished for thanking Kayleigh McEnany for liking their pizza. That's it, they're done. So Rick Wilson tweeted that Domino's had killed their brand by showing appreciation for McEnany. Domino's came back with one of the biggest owns of the century. They responded, "Well, it's unfortunate that thanking a customer for a compliment back in 2012 would be viewed as political. Guess that's 2020 for ya." Not the most revelatory of tweets, not the most insane comeback ever, but it's really nice and refreshing to just see a brand not cave in to the social media mob for once. They didn't apologize. They didn't try to walk it back. They just laid the facts out exactly as they are. This is a tweet from 2012, just thanking a customer. Doesn't have to be deeper than that, Rick. Now, the great part of all of this is that because Rick Wilson decided to go shoveling and digging for old tweets, a bunch of people decided that they were going to give him a taste of his own medicine. And of course, they found the typical anti-Joe Biden, anti-Democrat tweets that you would normally see in the history of a Never Trumper. None of these were particularly surprising because we all know that the Never Trumpers lost their minds after 2016 and basically abandoned all of the principles they used to hold. But what was really surprising, or at the very least hilarious, is that people found these photos on Instagram that showed Rick Wilson and his wife lugging around a cooler that had been painted with a Confederate flag. the reason this is so hysterical is that the Lincoln Project, Rick Wilson's little pack, has been tweeting out these attacks on Republican politicians for being pictured in front of Confederate flags or being near Confederate flags, what have you. And meanwhile, here he is owning an object that has been custom painted with the Confederate flag, and on the top says, "The South will rise again." Initially, Rick's wife tried to claim that this cooler was photoshopped, but it appeared in several different Instagram photos between the couple, including in the back of a moving van. So they apparently thought this cooler was so important and so great that they had to take it with them when they moved. Then she eventually claimed that the cooler belonged to their son, and that anyone who was attacking them for using the cooler was thereby attacking their 17-year-old son. Not a very good defense, considering they apparently didn't have a problem with featuring this cooler in their photos. Rick has basically accused everyone of melting down over this on his Twitter account. I don't think that's right. I think everyone just thinks that it's hilarious how badly he got destroyed by first Domino's Pizza and then by people who are better at the internet than he is. But Rick is the type of person who likes to pretend that he's above it all and doesn't really care and is just making fun of everything. But you can tell just how upset this campaign made him, and I think that's really great. The Washington Post has effectively ruined a woman's life over a 2-year-old incident at a Halloween party. It may sound like an Onion headline, but it's not. This is real life. What happened is a woman named Sue Schaefer, who was a graphic designer for the Washington Post, attended a 2018 Washington Post Halloween party and unfortunately made the mistake of dressing up in blackface. Never a good idea, but here's what the woman's costume was actually intended to be, and clearly she was not intending to be racist. This was right around the time that Megyn Kelly had been fired from NBC News for talking about wearing blackface on Halloween on her show, and Sue was dressed up as Megyn Kelly in blackface as a way of trying to make fun of Megyn Kelly. So making fun of someone who she believed to be a racist. She wasn't trying to be racist herself. Obviously, a lot of people at the Washington Post party misconstrued this attempt and got really upset with Sue for her costume. Two of these people were women of color who actually did not know the host of the party, but decided to confront Sue and yell at her for her costume and force her to leave. Sue ended up leaving the party, and she emailed and spoke to the host the following day to apologize for her costume, saying she didn't intend to cause any harm and that she was very ashamed of the fact that she had worn it. That should have been the end of the incident right there, right? Two adults confront someone who they have an issue with, the woman leaves the party, apologizes for her behavior, and great, we can all move on. Except that's not what happened here, because one of the women who confronted Sue decided to send an email to the host of the party 2 years later in 2020 to raise the incident again and apparently get the Washington Post to dig into what happened. So the Washington Post decides to expend all of these resources on this story. They interview people from the Halloween party. They review all of these email communications. They talk to Sue. They talk to the host of the party. And they reach out to Sue's employer. They do all of this journalism for something that's not even a news story. It involves no one of public note. It's about a private Halloween party. No idea why we need to be reading about this in the Washington Post, but they spent all of this time on this story, of course, painting Sue out to be this horrible villain. So this woman, of course, who is still hung up on the incident 2 years later, gets what she wanted. After the Washington Post reaches out to Sue's employer, she gets fired. She lost her job because she made a mistake 2 years ago at a Halloween party. And this woman, who clearly has a very sad life and has nothing else better to do, has decided to bring this up again 2 years later. But she wasn't satisfied with that. This woman also decided that she needed to go after the host of the party because apparently he was not tough enough on Sue. He should have asked her to leave immediately and then tried to protect his friend when he saw that this woman was coming after her again. So this guy, I guess, is going to they're going to try to make him the second casualty of this cancel culture scenario. It's a really sad state in our culture when these people don't accept redemption or forgiveness. Basically, anyone who makes a mistake is then wedded to that mistake for the rest of their life. And not only that, but their mistake is going to be plastered on the pages of America's elite newspapers and shared across the nation. So you can never be redeemed for your mistakes now. They are going to follow you for the rest of your life. It's a really sad state of our culture. It has horrible implications for everyone because guess what? No one is perfect. And this is going to lead to a whole lot of people eventually, I hope, lashing out at this type of social media mob behavior. And they're going to start refusing to apologize for anything that they've done wrong because they've learned that it's not really about the apology. It's about these certain people who have a hole in their life that they need to fill, seeking vengeance on people that they don't like or that have wronged them in some way. So that's it for this week's episode of Unfit to Print. Thank you guys so much for watching. And I want to point out that the story I talked about earlier with the Federalist and NBC News and Google is proof more than ever that you guys are playing a huge role in protecting conservative media by sharing our content, by subscribing to our channels, and watching the content that we put out there, because it's only the bigger and popular outlets that are able to protect themselves from this type of big tech censorship. Unfortunately, it's the little guys who often get screwed in this situation. So my only ask of you is to keep watching Unfit to Print, share it with your friends, subscribe to the Daily Caller's YouTube channel, subscribe to The Spectator, and just make it impossible for these people to shut us up. So again, thank you guys so much for watching. We always appreciate your support, and we will see you next week.